Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He tells us financials are coming to life. He runs down gold, crude, and the U.S. and Canadian dollars. Vancouver will also get to feel the so-called Taylor Swift financial effect. The Trendletter.com's Martin Straith joins us to chat about bonds, interest rates, Canada's confusing fiscal and monetary policies, and whether the U.S. and Canada are in recession as we face a slowing global economy. Tim Cycles Van Wood talks about the root causes of our current inflationary cycle, the health of U.S. banks, and whether there is any so-called safe haven if we go into a recession. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you, Jim.
Ross, how would you describe what happened in the stock markets this week?
Well, this was the year, the week that the financials came to life. The seasonal factors just came into play exactly where you anticipate they would. The last week of October, first week of November, you historically, that's where you're going to see the seasonals kick in, and you get your positive 6 months starting. And this one got off to a really good start. We, you know, it was 2 weeks ago that we got some good oversold signals in all of these broad indexes, and including the Russell 2000, which has been really the dog of everything out there, having made new lows recently on the year. And the, you know, combined with the oversold conditions that we had, and then the bond market, which had just been decimated for this last year, during the month of October, we saw the commercial positions increase to significantly large positions, and the speculators became extremely short. And so as soon as the economic numbers are starting to slow down here, and you got 150,000 on the jobs this week versus 180,000 on the estimate, then you're getting this reversal in bonds. So it's just everything's fitting in for, you know, some good times in at least the short term. So, you know, overall measurement on the bond yields, we had been looking for levels up around 5% for the 10-year and the 30-year bonds, and those have now pulled back pretty sizably in the first week. We're down to 4.55 on the 10-year, 4.75 on the 30-year. So there's a bit of a breather there. And when you look over at the financials, the stocks, the financials, the industrials, utilities, all making really good moves off the bottoms, up anywhere from 5 to 8% on the week. So, you know, some of these REITs, the real estate investment trusts that have got maybe 7 or 8% yields in them, had a 7% move on the upside just on their price this week on top of that. So good to see that the seasonals are happening, and you know, it should see some continuation here.
What's going on with gold?
Well, when you have the type of numbers that we do as far as the economy is concerned and slowing, then I mean, the lower interest rates should be helpful for the gold market. It doesn't have to compete as much. But on the other side of the coin, the we were, unpleasantly surprised, to say, with the action in gold. It was a choppy week. The last couple of weeks coming off that $1,800 low was pretty darn good. But it's stuck now, trying to get through 2,000. Took a pause this week. Same type of thing happened over in silver. They look as though they're still poised for a breakout, but the seasonals on the precious metals really don't start to turn positive in a big way until we get out to December. So maybe a little bit more time to be spent in here. The commitment of traders numbers, we saw a pretty good swing here, and about a 15,000 contract swing is from the commercials and the speculator position. So for all that it was extremely bullish a few weeks ago, they're back in more to neutral territory right now. The money management positions, which had been net short at about 15,000 contracts, are now net long 73,000. And usually coming off an extreme low like we saw there, you see those money managers get up, so have a net bullish position of over 100,000 contracts. So there's still running room as far as gold is concerned from that perspective. One good thing to see at the end of the week, the miners, which have really not been doing too much, we saw some of the big ones, the Kinross, Alamos, Wheaton, which have been holding up well. They had a pretty respectable end of the week, and the GDXJ, the ETF of the miners, closed out of its bearish downward channel that it's been in for the last number of months. So there's a little bit of light there right now. Still, we're having trouble at this $2,000 level. Any pullbacks, I think, that we get in here should hold around the 1950 to 1960 level.
What's going on with crude?
So in crude oil, the market had a bit of a blip on the upside Friday morning. Couldn't hold that, and by the end of the week, we're down at around 80.5. As I mentioned last week, if it can't hold that support around 81 or 82, which it's now having difficulty with, I think 76 is the next stop on the downside, and the seasonals are not that favorable for crude oil right now. So a pause would be to be expected.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
U.S. dollar had just a horrendous close off on the week, closed at a five-week low, and we're going to be looking for, now originally it was a good support a week and a half ago when it bounced, then we've seen this sort of a double top pattern in here, and if anything, probably get down and correct to the longer-term moving averages. So we're probably looking at about the 104.5 level for support as far as the dollar index. And as the dollar went, U.S. dollar went down, all the other currencies are up. Canadian dollar had its first decent bounce in quite a while. So I think that when we finally see an interim low on the U.S. dollar, you're probably looking at a 73.5, maybe 74 cent Canadian. But overall, the trend of the Canadian dollar looks as though it's still down. It just needs to get rid of some of this oversold that we've had for the last month or so.
Now, in our Anything Else file, we have Taylor Swift is bringing her Eras Tour to Vancouver December next year on the 6th, 7th, and 8th. And each one of her concerts can bring a city between $10 and $40 million. And for local speculators, imagine what you could sell those tickets for if you're lucky enough to get a pair, and they're limiting it to four per customer.
Well, isn't that something? I wouldn't. I'd love to get in on that game, but no, that's... and how are they going to stop the scalpers from making some big money out of this stuff?
Well, you can't. In Canada, or at least in BC, it's perfectly legal. It's private property. You can sell it.
Okay. Well, I'll have to put the, we'll do some charts on that and just see what looks like to be one of our exhaustion tops.
And it is on the shoulder season. The cruise ship season is over for Vancouver, but skiing hasn't started, so people aren't on their way to Whistler yet. So you might even be able to find some hotel rooms and imagine what they're going to charge for those.
Oh, yes. I know that was exorbitant in Seattle not that long ago, so Vancouver will definitely outdo the what they saw down south of the border.
Ross, always a pleasure chatting with you.
Good to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Martin Strath next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Martin Strath, founder of Trend News Online at TheTrendLetter.com. He's speaking to us from Coquitlam, B.C., which is just east of Vancouver. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Oh, good to be here, Jim. Thanks.
What's your take on bonds, especially given that most central banks have paused on their rate hikes?
Yeah, I mean, this last week we've seen, Bank of Canada, the Fed, Bank of England, ECB, I think the Swiss National Bank also. So they all held rates at the current level. So, you know, and most of these central bankers, you know, they're saying inflation's still too high and it's likely going to stay high for longer. But they all also are saying that they want to allow these rates to take effect. So all the hikes they've been doing, they know there's going to be a lagging effect, so they want to, you know, they want to let that happen and sort of kind of be more data dependent. You know, in August of 2020, so, you know, a little over 3 years ago, the U.S. 10-year yield was 0.5%. A couple of weeks ago, it was 5%. I mean, that's a whopping 900% increase in just 3 years. So that's been such a dramatic increase. So, you know, that increase in borrowing cost is just now starting to impact consumers. You know, I just saw a report from RBC, and it estimates that 60% of Canadian mortgages are coming due between now and 2026. So now we've got central banks, they've been slow to react to all the changes in the economy. You know, they said that inflation was transitory, and so they kept rates down until inflation was over 8%. Then they finally started to raise rates, and now they're way behind the curve. So, you know, but they're not stupid, and they do know that these rate increases do have this lagging effect. And so they want to tread carefully here, knowing that a recession is very possible in the next 6 months. So today, we saw unemployment data in both Canada and the U.S., and it was down for both countries. So that's going to take some pressure off the central banks. So, you know, we're seeing this week how that the bond and the stock markets are both betting that the Fed is done raising rates. We're seeing both bonds and stocks being bought up this week. So I suspect that they are done raising rates, but I do believe that, you know, if there's another spike in inflation, then they are going to consider hiking rates again. So, you know, for your listeners, for investors, just so they know, we do not recommend buying long-term government bonds. But certainly shorter term, you know, in a one-year government bond, you can get over 5%. And, you know, certainly that's a very reasonable stake play.
Stock markets seem to like the Fed pause. What's your take on the stock markets?
Yeah, you know, the stock market, you know, right now is perfectly synced with seasonality. We've been talking about this quite a bit with our subscribers over the last few months. You know, we saw the S&P, the benchmark S&P, down for three consecutive months from August to October, so it dropped about 10% in that time frame, and you know that is typically the weakest time of the year for the stock. And then you know, at last week, at the bottom of that, we saw that the S&P dropped below its 200-day moving average, and that 200-day moving average happened to coincide with its year-long uptrend line. So dropping below both of those was very bullish, but it also put the market into very oversold condition. So now we've got this week, we got the rock markets rallying, you know, the Fed had announced that they were going to pause. And so that's given a big boost to stock. And all of this, again, fits perfectly with the seasonality trend where, you know, August to October is very weak, but November and December are typically the strongest months for equities. So, you know, since I think it's 1990, the S&P 500 has been up about 75% of the time in that late October to year-end time frame. And, you know, so far, you know, this week, starting on Tuesday, you know, November kicked off, you know, starting very well. And, you know, this week looks like, I'm just looking at the close here. So, yeah, it looks like this week will be the best week of the year so far. So other thing we've had is we had the fear and greed index at extreme fear levels last week. We had the relative strength index was very oversold last week. So, again, this was all telling us, you know, these are contrarian indicators. So when they get to these extreme levels like they did, that tells us that the market is going to swing the other way, and that's exactly what's happening this week. So today, you know, we have lower interest rates, we've got lower oil prices, we got a weaker U.S. dollar. Those are all positives for the equity market. And, you know, even today, you know, we've got this weaker job data. Well, that's considered good news for stocks because that tells investors that the Bank of Canada and the Fed are less likely to raise rates. Now, if we look on the negative side, though, of course, we've got these two wars going on, you know, Russia, Ukraine, Hamas, and Israel. So any escalation in either of those wars would certainly spook the market. And, you know, the chance of escalation in the Middle East certainly is possible, if not likely. Now, the other thing that we've been watching and we're kind of watching for is I think we're going to see some more problems in the U.S. banking system. You know, we had those big problems back in March. We had a number of banks go down. You know, and then the Fed and the Treasury, of course, they just came in and they papered over those problems by printing more money out of thin air. So I really think that there's that problem is still out there, and I think it's going to be a much bigger liquidity problem, and I think it's going to start hitting some of the bigger banks. So that's a shock that's going to really hit the markets at some point. But, you know, right now, it's all green light. You know, we're in the positive season period. You know, so right now, stock market's doing well. So as long as we don't get another black swan event, we should see a good year-end rally. So today, the S&P just closed, it looks like at 43.58. So, you know, our targets right now, we're watching near-term resistance, 43.75. So that's, what, another 17 points. So we're pretty close to that first resistance level. And then 44.15. On the support side, we're looking at 200-day moving average again, so 42.45. And then the next support would be 41.10. But again, for now, it looks positive for a year-end rally.
When you were on last month, you had targeted about $94 for a near-term high for oil. Since then, it hit that target, dropped down to about 82. Where do you see oil going from here?
Yeah. Oil's tracked our model's projections almost perfectly this last year. So, we hit that target. I think it was just about a week after we were talking about it. So on the near-term bullish side, you know, unfortunately, the bullish side is we've got these wars going on. So Russia and Ukraine and Hamas and Israel. So if we see an escalation, especially if we see Iran getting involved, then crude's going to get a big boost. And that's going to bring uncertainty about production and shipment out of the Middle East. Now, on the bearish side, you know, we've got slowing economies, especially in Europe. You know, got Germany and Sweden. You got China. We've got Japan. And also, you know, Canada and the U.S. are likely going to struggle here soon. So if we get a global recession, that would certainly cause oil prices to drop. Now, oil right now is sitting at 80.98. So, you know, our next target, near-term support was at 79. So we're, you know, about $2 off of that. And then we got a really strong support around the $74 level. So, and resistance, if we hit 88, then the next resistance would be that 94 high that we talked about last time. Now, longer term, you know, on the demand side, we've got India, you know, we've got these other emerging countries. You know, these countries are growing, they're expanding, they need more energy, they need electricity. A lot of these countries don't have electricity in half the areas. So that's going to really ramp up demand. Also, China's been kind of stagnant. We're seeing some stimulus packages going out there. And I think that, you know, ultimately China's going to get going again, and that's going to really boost demand long term. Now, on the supply side, you know, we've got lack of investment. We've got declining rig counts. We've got capital expenditures in the oil sector down to, you know, near 40-year lows. And you know, the main, one of the main reasons there is we've got governments globally do not like fossil fuels. So they continue to, you know, increase windfall taxes, increase regulations, not allowing any permitting. So you combine all of that, so you've got increased demand, reduced supply. Well, that's just going to create a huge supply problem over the next few years. So we're going to see $100 oil for sure, $150 very likely, and probably higher in the next 1 to 3 years. So, you know, for your listeners on pullbacks, you know, companies that we're looking at, you know, we've already invested in, you know, companies like Mega Energy, Crescent Point, XLE. On our list, we got Cenovus, Baytex, Athabasca, and a bunch more. So there's lots of them to look at. We're also looking to add the USO Oil Fund, because it's more of a pure play on oil prices and as opposed to oil stocks. Because if we do get a further stock market pullback, you know, it tends to bring oil stocks down, even if the price of oil is rising. So, you know, an example would be if we had a big escalation in the Middle East, that's going to, you know, drop the stock market down, which will also probably bring this oil stocks down, but oil price goes up, so USO would go up. So we're tracking all that in the trend letter, and as you know, we publish all this stuff every week. So
last month you mentioned investors should think about getting into natural gas. What's the story there now?
Yeah. Well, last month, natural gas had been just consolidating since February. It had primarily been doing nothing. It'd been just going sideways, been trading between $2 and $3 throughout that whole period. But since we were talking about it, soon after, we saw natural gas break that $3 level. And today it's trading at about $3.50. So it's starting to, you know, it's starting to trend up, which is good. You know, we've been very patient throughout this period. You know, we invested in natural gas a while ago, and just sitting there waiting for it to make a move. And our patience is based on the fact that we think this winter is going to be much different than last winter, especially in Europe with the El Nino. You know, according to all the weather experts, this weather in El Nino is going to bring colder temperatures to northern Europe, and that's going to be much different to the warm temperatures they had last winter. And then if you look at North America, you know, the expectation is for colder weather in the east and the southern U.S. with warmer in the west. So if you're a long-term investor, you know, buying natural gas on any dip around here would be a good idea. Couple ways you can play it. If you're American and you want to, or if you want to play on the U.S. exchange, there's the UNG ETF. And in Canada, you've got the HUF.
Gold hit right on your target low of 1825 days after you were on late September. What do you see ahead for that precious metal?
Yeah, gold has also tracked our model's projections really well. So, you know, since making a double top in April and May at 2070, gold had a real trouble trying to break through and close above the $2,000 level. And like I say, when I was on back at the end of September, we discussed how our models were looking at 1825 as a really key support level. And, you know, sure enough, the following week it bottomed just under 1820, and then it spiked. You know, unfortunately, the crisis in the Middle East erupted and gold took off. So gold rallied from that 1820 level right up to 2000 again. But this time, it did manage to close above 2000. I think it got up to about almost 2020. Now, since that high, gold's kind of pulled back a little bit, hanging around that 2000 level. I'm just checking here now. It's so 2002. So, you know, to get through this near-term resistance here around this 2000 level, we need to see a solid multi-day close above 2000, and then we need to see it close above 2025. And if we can do that, ultimately, we need to take another run at that April and May high at 2070. Now, if we can break through 2070, our models call for a run up to through 2300 and even to 2320. So near-term support would be 1950, than 1900. Now, if 1900 doesn't hold, that would not be good. And then we could see another test of that really strong support at 1825. But for now, we're looking at, you know, another run at 2070 and ultimately breaking through a strong resistance and hopefully a potential run at 2300, 2328 range.
What about the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. We talked a number of times here. You know, back in mid-July, we saw a real change in markets all across the board. You know, with currencies, it's all about the U.S. dollar. So if the U.S. dollar is strong, then that negatively affects most other currencies, commodities, equities, and precious metals. And that's exactly what we saw starting from that key mid-July date. We saw the U.S. dollar turn higher, and then that most other currencies, equities, precious metals, and commodities, they all started to turn down. And then we saw foreign capital, you know, basically moving into the U.S. dollar, out of the euro, and into the yen. So again, all of this stuff's connected. So the reason for the recent high in the U.S. dollar has been the simple fact that the U.S. interest rates are much higher than all these other central banks. So now on Wednesday, you know, we had the Fed's pause on their rate, but so did all the other major central banks, meaning that the U.S. central bank rate at 5.5% is still higher than the U.K. at 5.25%, higher than Canada's at 5%, and higher than the ECB at 4%. So, you know, the big question that we see that the mainstream media is all debating feverishly here is how soon is the Fed going to cut rates? And to me, the real question should be, who is going to cut rates first? Because much of Europe is in a recession, as is Japan. Canada is technically, you know, primarily the primary data is saying Canada is very close to a recession. So, well, we've been noting that the current trend of strong U.S. dollar, weaker Canadian, weaker euro, weaker yen, and pound, it was getting very overdone. So our models are showing that that was getting very overdone. So we've been expecting that we'd see a reversal soon, at least temporarily, and that's exactly what we're seeing this week. So this week we're seeing the U.S. dollar down a bit, and all these other currencies have been rallying. Now, also, the strong U.S. dollar puts massive pressure on these developing countries which have huge U.S. denominated debt. So we're expecting that the central banks behind the scenes, they all get together and they start manipulating the numbers. So I'm thinking we're probably starting to see some intervention here, but I don't think it's going to last for too long. So near-term resistance for the U.S. dollar is 108. Ultimately, I could see it hitting 115. Near-term support is about 104 and then 102.75. So Jim, long-term, we're still quite bullish on the U.S. dollar. Not because any of these other currencies are good. It's just that the U.S. dollar is basically the least ugly house on the street here. So if we look at the Canadian, like I said, it's all connected to the U.S. dollar. So, you know, the Canadian dollar has been just getting hammered lately. We've got weak economic data and a much stronger U.S. economy. So initial data suggesting that, Canada's technically in a recession. So with weak economic data, Bank of Canada is going to be less likely to raise rates. So that means Canada's rate's going to remain lower than the U.S. rate, and that means the Canadian dollar is going to remain lower than the U.S. dollar. So Canadian rate now is trading at 73.12 today. I have a nice little bounce this week. Key resistance for the Canadian is at 74.50. Near-term supports at 72. But honestly, I'm pretty sure I mentioned this last time, Jim. I think the Canadian dollar is going to drop below 70 this year. Or not this year, but in the next year. And, 68 would be our target by sometime in 2024.
The Bank of Canada Governor Tiff Macklin, whose name sounds like a hockey player from the 1930s, stated fiscal and monetary policies were rowing in the opposite direction. What's your take? And by the way, our Prime Minister is famous for saying he doesn't think about monetary policy.
No, he doesn't. Interesting. And it kind of seems to show. We've been writing about this for quite a while. The only sources of revenue for government are taxes and fees. So when they spend more than they collect in taxes and fees, then they have to go out and borrow more money and issue bonds. So I know a few months ago when we discussed how the pandemic relief packages that the Bank of Canada, the Fed, pretty much all central banks were issuing, that was a big reason for the high inflation. You know, we had the global lockdowns, so that shut down the supply chain. And then we had these trillions of dollars of relief packages sent out to all the households and businesses. And, you know, that created more demand for goods. And, you know, the simple result was higher demand and reduced supply equals inflation. So, you know, I can totally understand the frustration of the central banks today trying to bring down inflation while these governments keep spending far more than they bring in revenue. You know, governments have to keep issuing more bonds to pay for all these programs that they keep spending on. So now, with interest rates at 5% for a 10-year bond, you know, governments are having to pay more and more just to service their debt. You know, in the U.S., the cost of financing the government debt just reached almost, it's just under $1 trillion last year. I mean, it's crazy. The U.S. deficit for the fiscal year that just ended was $1.7 trillion. And that's a 24% increase over the year before that. I mean, it's a massive increase in spending. So their government debt now is over $33 trillion, and that works out to $100,000 per person. In Canada, it's not quite as bad, but it's still pretty outrageous. You know, our total government debt is $1.2 trillion, and that, you know, we've got 40 million people. Well, that works out to $30,000 per person in Canada. So, you know, we've got central banks trying to keep, keep the rates high in order to fight inflation. And then on the other side, we've got the governments continuing their massive spending, which is inflationary. I mean, it's pretty dysfunctional.
There is a report in the Financial Post saying the Canadian economy technically is on track for a recession. Do you agree with that? And what about the U.S. and recession?
Yeah, I saw that. It's, the Canadian economy was down 0.1% in the third quarter versus the Bank of Canada's forecast of a 0.8% increase. So that was quite a bit off. And that followed a contraction of 0.2% in the second quarter. So, you know, a definition of a recession is two consecutive negative quarters. Hmm. So, I mean, that's what was published. That's preliminary data. Now, unfortunately, all this data, the governments always manipulate this stuff after the fact anyways. But yeah, I certainly think that we're going to see a recession in Canada and the U.S. because of all the lagging effect of the inflation and the lagging effect of all these increases is going to hit consumers. Consumers represent, over 60% of GDP. And if they can't afford to go out and buy new stuff, and can only spend on it on the essentials, then that's going to hit the economy. You know, credit card debt is rising dramatically in the U.S. Credit card debt just hit over $1 trillion in a report last week. So you've got percentage-wise, you've got Canadians even more in debt than the U.S. So with this high interest rate, it's making servicing these debts even more challenging for most households. You know, in Canada, consumer confidence dropped for the second consecutive month, and it's at the lowest level since the pandemic. In the U.S., consumer confidence is down for the third month in a row. So, you know, now we have both the inverted yield curve and the Conference Board's leading economic index. Now, these are both leading indicators, and they both have a near-perfect record of forecasting recessions, and both of them are forecasting a recession in the U.S. So for Canada, you know, with our dollar so weak against the U.S. dollar, I mean, it means imports, particularly food, especially in the winter, they're going to cost more, and that's going to put an even bigger burden on the Canadian consumer. So, yeah, I think we will definitely see a recession in both countries in 2024. But I think, you know, I'm pretty sure I mentioned this last time I was on, you know, recessions are tough, but if we get a recession, at the end of a recession, they always present great buying opportunities. So, you know, during a recession, it's brutal. I mean, stocks get crushed, you know, the markets crash. But once everybody's out, once everybody's sworn off stocks, they'll never buy stocks again, that's when you want to have cash and be ready to scoop up the bargains. The last five recessions have brought us some great buying opportunities. So if we get a recession, which I think we're going to, have some cash ready, and be, you know, wait for our buy signals.
Martin, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
I think, you know, the key to me is, you know, if we do get this seasonal year-end rally, which I think we will do, as long as we don't get a black swan event. So, you know, and, you know, obviously the escalation in the Middle East is the real concern to me. But I think that, you know, it's a fairly green light right now. So unless we get something out of nowhere, and, you know, and I guess I can't even say out of nowhere. I mean, the Middle East issue is still looming very large right now. I mean, I think if Iran starts getting involved, that's going to be real trouble. But if we can somehow avoid all that, I think we're going to have a nice rally into the year end.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
My pleasure, Jim. Just so your subscribers or listeners want to know, they can, if they have any interest in, we have three services, the Trend Letter, Technical Trader, and the Trend Disruptors. So the Trend Letter is, you know, comes out every Sunday, covers equities, currencies, precious metals, commodities, and bonds. Audience is for people that just want a better understanding of what's driving these markets. You know, each week, mostly charts, key bullet points to make it really easy to understand. Then we have the Technical Trader, which was originally a hedging service, but now invests in long positions and covers all the major sectors as well. And it includes the gold technical indicator, which is a proprietary model of ours. Audience there for more active investors, but certainly long-term investors can also benefit, and certainly from the hedging strategies there. It's an online service, updates every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday after the market close. And then Trend Disruptors, that's a monthly service, invest in disruptive areas. So you're talking, you know, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, 5G, cloud, Internet of Things, very speculative sector. So again, the audience here would be those wishing to speculate, but only with capital they could afford to lose. Now, listeners can also sign up. We have a free service called Headlines. And what we do every weekday morning is we go out and we scour the news, and then we send out the headlines that we think every investor should be aware of. And that's just it's a free service. No spam, no things trying to get you to buy other things and so on. So if any listener wants to get on that, just simply go to thetrendletter.com. So that's all one word, thetrendletter.com. And if they have any questions and need some more information, just email us at info@thetrendletter.com.
My guest has been Martin Strath, founder of Trend News, online at thetrendletter.com. He was speaking to us from Coquitlam, BC, which is just east of Vancouver. Coming up, Tim Cyclesman Wood, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Tim Cyclesman Wood, editor of Cycles News and Views on cyclesman.com. He's speaking to us from beautiful Gulf Shores, Alabama. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Jim, thanks for having me.
Tim, can you tell us a little bit about your newsletter and why Tim Cyclesman Wood?
Well, Jim, I mean, it's I call it a research letter more so than a newsletter, because it's, you know, I dig in the rabbit hole looking for, it really is, I guess the best way to describe it is it's a quantitative analysis of trend. You know, I search for common denominators, tying things to cycle tops and bottoms to try to come up with a quantitative approach for guiding us through the markets, and it actually works pretty well.
Yes. Now, getting into the markets, since the August high, a lot of people were saying, we're in for a nasty correction here. What's your point of view on that?
Well, you know, I was looking for a nasty correction too, you know, and my big picture has not changed. Let me preface this just a little bit. You know, I couldn't be more bearish with this. You know, we've talked about this bubble. That has not changed. We've talked about how it's been fueled and fabricated and fueled by, you know, the monetary policy. We've talked about how it's the biggest bubble in history, and I think it's going to, you know, be the biggest unwinding in history when we get the proper setup. But seeing how this thing set up, and this is a perfect example of the quantitative analysis of the approach, is that at the August high, I didn't have the things in place that I needed to see to say that we had seen the top. And I didn't expect to find myself in that position, because going into the August high, you know, when back in June and into July, we had the things in place that I needed to see. But then with that push up into July and into early August, things changed. And so the some of the things that I'm looking for, need to see, in conjunction with the top, they just kind of morphed away. So since the August high, I've been saying, no, I don't think that's the high. And unless this thing has somehow been papered over for the first time since the history of the averages in 1896, I do not see, or I've been saying that I did not see, the required setup to call that the top. And so while I knew that there was a correction, I agree, I knew that there were some cycle lows coming in the October-November time frame, I do not think and did not think and still don't think that we've seen the top. I think that we're now probably at that intermediate term low, if not one more little push down, but we're probably at that intermediate term low, and that's going to leave us set up for that additional push up. And then if we see the right things fall into place, you know, the quantitative things that I need to see, and then the right structure fall in place, then we'll be in a position where, yeah, we could see this thing start to unravel. But, you know, it makes me nervous. I didn't think I would find myself in that position calling for higher prices in this time frame. And then you look at what's going on in the world, with the world seemingly falling apart, and then to be in a position where you're calling for higher highs, it puts you on the other side of the fence all of a sudden. And that's kind of a tough call, but that's what I see.
Hmm. Now, Tim, you said in the past when you've called things right, people criticized you, and yet the real facts, the real numbers kept coming in, backing up your point of view. Is that the case that you're seeing this time, that you're pretty sure you're right, that the numbers are lining up in the direction that you feel they're going to go in, and yet people are yelling at you, but that's not what we think?
Well, give you two yeah. examples without going into the details. There's a couple of things that have occurred. Let me give you an example, answer that question, and give you an example of the quantitative approach that I have. If I tell you that every top since the inception of the industrials and the transports in 1896, if I tell you that I've seen a specific setup with every top or every four-year cycle top since 1896, and that top was absent at the August high, then obviously odds are heavily, heavily, heavily against that August high having been the four-year cycle top. So how do you go against those odds? I mean, maybe, but are you willing to bet against something that's never happened? I mean, you might be right, but the odds are thin. And then there's a second DNA marker, I call it, that at every four-year cycle top since 1896, in all but one occurrence, it has been present. So there was one exception since 1896, but here I didn't see the top. So is this another one of those one exceptions? And when you combine those two independent events, you know, what are the odds? And not to mention the structure of the cycles themselves. So, yeah, I mean, odds just do not favor that having been the high. Now, again, that does not change my longer-term view. I still think this is a disaster. I think it's the biggest bubble in history, but I don't think we're there yet. And, you know, I've been asked the question, well, what if you're wrong? Well, if this should be the first time in history, like I said, that we see the top with without that combination of, you know, those structural events that we need to see in place, then, you know, there is a fail-safe. There are other indicators that I'm looking at, overriding things that I'm looking at that with the structure. I say indicators with the structure itself that will tell me, but I don't see that at this point. So anyway, hope that answers the question, and it serves as an example of the kind of quantitative approach. And it always puts you, it seems like, on the opposite end with people because, you know, they see one thing, but the data tends to, you know, point towards something else, and people can never see, you know, they see what they see. They don't necessarily can see the underlying facts or statistics, you know, obviously.
Now, one thing that we've discussed in past programs is the cause of inflation. Of course, the U.S. Fed, the Bank of Canada, the Bank of England, they're upping interest rates on the premise that it was an oversupply of money that caused the inflation. Your point of view is something different.
My point of view has been ever since this COVID thing started in 2021 that this was a supply chain induced inflation, and that they raised rates chasing, if you will, I say chasing. It's like Richard Russell used to say a long time ago. He used to say, and his saying was, inflate or die, inflate or die. The Fed has to inflate or die. And that's exactly what they had to do. And the inflation started with the supply chain induced shortages, and then they, to justify that, they needed to raise rates. So they put the square peg in a round hole again, forcing rates up. They started that with, you know, jawboning rates higher, saying that they had to raise rates to fight inflation. And how does raising rates solve a supply chain issue? It doesn't. And they also used the reverse repos to put a floor under interest rates, and they forced rates higher so that they could, again, as Richard Russell used to say many years ago, inflate or die. And so this whole thing was fabricated to inflate, to keep it alive. And now we sit here with, you know, what should be at the top of a rate hiking cycle. We're not there yet, I don't think. The short end is trying to soften a little bit here. In the process, let me digress for a minute. In the process of this forced rate hiking cycle, I go back and I want to remind you that, you know, we talked about this, I think it was in February of 21, I saw a signal, maybe it was March of 21, a signal that has always occurred at the top of a rate hiking cycle, never at the bottom of a rate hiking cycle, always has occurred at the top of a cycle. And it occurred prior to them ever even raising rates, prior to the first rate hike. And so that told me that it wasn't a bad signal. What it told us is that rates should have gone down that was the natural tendency, and that we were set up for what I call my checkmate chart to activate. We were set up for rates to actually turn below zero. They had to defend that line. Well, in the process, and enforcing rates higher, I think they have broken the back of the bond market, and that probably wasn't intended, but it's happened. Looking at the long-term structure, there's 3-year dominant 3-year cycle in the long bond that'll follow, and that has definitely been broken. So I think there may have been some unintended consequences there that have not come to the surface just yet.
On the bond market, what's your outlook there?
Well, I think we're setting up to see a renormalization of the curve, but within the context of higher rates. Let me explain that. On with the long end, I can't confirm it yet, but we're in the ballpark for an intermediate to longer term, a little bit longer term low, and so that should give us a pretty good bounce in the bond market itself. So we should see rates turn lower on the long end. But I think that's counter trend, and because of the longer term cycles being broken, and then I think that the resumption to the downside with bonds and higher rates will continue. On the short end, I think that we're in the zone. We're close. We're I can't say we're there yet, but looking at the models, we're in the ballpark where we should start to see this short end peaking. Can they pull another, force another rate hiking cycle? I mean, another rate hike? Maybe, but we're in the zone where we should be real close. I mean, there's some models that say that we're there, and then looking at some of the other data, when you put it under the microscope, like looking at, I can't remember what it was, I was looking at it recently, but like when the unemployment growth rate went above the zero line, what was the time lag between the first rate cut and that occurrence? And you know, in some cases, it was like 18 months or something. So, like I said, we're in the ballpark for that turn, I think, but I haven't seen evidence that it's happened yet. And that's something else I'm watching in the letter. But once that short-term rate starts to turn with the longer end broken, as I said, I think we're going to see a renormalization of the curve. But that's also part of the setup with something I call the checkmate chart for their overall setup of this bubble.
The Fed is supposed to, I guess, look after the economy, make sure there's enough jobs, reasonable interest rates. But it seems to me the only thing they look at is interest rates, whether you have a job or not, or a way to support yourself, does not seem to be on their agenda at all. Is that true?
Well, that would be my assumption as well. I think that it's all about Wall Street manipulating the price of the stock market and holding it up.
So the Fed really doesn't have your back. All they care about are the banks okay? Because, I mean, the Fed is the biggest banks in the U.S., chaired by somebody appointed by the government. Isn't that how it works?
Exactly. I mean, yeah. Their interest is in the banks, yeah. Not you. Of course. Hmm.
The banks have been doing in the U.S. Do you think the banking crisis is over? We had two massive failures, a third one thrown in there as well, I think. Do you think they're still on shaky ground?
Absolutely. And, you know, another point, talking about quantitative analysis and the sort of thing I do back earlier in the year. Actually, it was late November, but I wrote about it early this year, late last November, to clarify. The growth rate of M2 declined below the zero line for the first time in many, 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 many years, since 1958, I think, and or 57, 58, whatever it was. And I had identified that, and that was when I say since 58, that was a blip that was definitely an exception because of some other things. But anyway, going back in time, every time that has happened, I had tied it to financial crises and banking crises and that sort of thing. It was all related. And in every one of those occurrences, those financial crises, of course, there were banking issues. So out of the blue, we see this, well, I say out of the blue because, it was happening, but it was on no one's radar screen. But we see the M2 growth rate late last November, early December, creep below the zero line, and then out of the blue, we see these banking crises you mentioned emerge. Well, that's history. That's part of what I'm talking about. So no, that hasn't gone away, I don't think. I think that was just probably the tip of the iceberg. It's kind of been papered over. Market's been overall up. Yes, we've seen a correction since August, but I don't think anything's broken there yet. And I think this is kind of a calm before the storm, if you will. I think there's much more to come.
What do you see ahead for gold?
Well, looking at gold, I think what we've seen is a counter trend rally. I'm not convinced that we've seen anything that's sustainable here. We did have an intermediate degree low in October, but at this point, I think this is counter trend. I could be wrong. I'd change my opinion if I see evidence to support that. But at this time, I think it's counter trend, and that it'll. I think what is happening is that gold will probably set up with something I call a left translated top, along with a setup of left translated cycles in the entire commodity complex. You know, the CRB, the BDI, you know, crude oil, and you know, like I said, the complex as a whole, and then that'll also be part of the setup with this checkmate chart in the overall unwinding.
What's going to happen with crude?
Same thing. I think we've seen a counter trend advance. I can't confirm just yet if this counter trend advance is over, but my hunch is that the advance that we've seen out of the May June low has been counter trend in crude oil in conjunction with that higher degree. There's cycles of various degrees and commodities. A dominant long term cycle is a 3-year cycle. I think that cycle bottomed in crude oil back in May, and my expectation is that we see a setup that you know, something I call left translation, a left translated cycle that sets up to leave us positioned to turn down out of this 6th long-term economic cycle. I know that doesn't make sense to someone who's not familiar with the work, but anyway, the point being is that I think that this advance we've seen out of May is counter-trend, and we may have seen that top already. Don't know yet, can't confirm it yet, don't have enough structure, but it's at risk, at very least, of having run its course.
The U.S. dollar, what's the picture there?
Again, I think the advance has been counter-trend. The 4-year top in the dollar, there's a dominant 4-year cycle. I think that the 4-year cycle top was seen last year, and the advance we've seen more recently, again, I believe is counter trend, and the 4-year cycle low should still lie ahead with one more push down. And to early to mid, probably mid 24 is kind of my time frame on that.
Now, getting back to the supply chain issue, we've both seen shortages of things. I know it's a first world problem, but the hot tub in my condo complex has been broken since June 1st, and they've just started the repairs on it. Now, they said the parts were held up in China somewhere. How many people are running into that problem where one little part is held up somewhere in the world?
You know, earlier in the year, I was on top of that a little closer. Yep. I was following it from an automotive perspective, kind of having friends that do hot rod stuff, and myself being somewhat involved in that. And I know that with car, you know, engine parts and car parts, that was a major, major, major problem earlier in the year. I really don't have my finger on that pulse at this point. I don't know if it's gotten better, worse, or the same. But I do know that it was a bad problem 5-6 months ago. And like I said, I don't have an update on my end if that has changed. I do know that, obviously, prices. I talked to a guy yesterday, a hot rod buddy yesterday, and he was telling me that the cost of building a short block, or you know, I may not mean anything to anybody that's not in the car world, but anyway, it's basically the bottom end of an engine. He said it was up 25% to 30% this year. He said you could have built the engine that engine last year for you know 25-30% less money. Same thing, the parts just you know skyrocketing.
Do you think hot rod enthusiasts will be disappointed with an electric vehicle world, or will they be trying to soup up their electric cars, or do they come hot enough as it is?
You know, I think man has been racing anything that moves since the beginning of time, and they'll somehow find a way to satisfy themselves racing and hot rodding whatever they have. But you know, be it bicycles or horses or whatever, doesn't matter. But personally, you know, I man, there's no replacement for a hot rod V8 engine in my mind in the hot rod world. But I'm sure that, you know, future generations, when the electric stuff is forced on them, they'll find a way to be satisfied hot rodding it and be happy doing it.
Are your neighbors switching to electric vehicles?
No, I don't see that. I see a few electric vehicles in town here, but very few. and I don't even know where there's a charging station in town. There's a little charging station at a rest area type, you know, truck stop type place up by the interstate near me. But as far as in town, I don't even know where there's a charging station. I don't see much of it here. No.
So, Tim, what's your overall outlook?
Well, my overall outlook is that we are seeing it, this thing. It look it's a ginormous bubble. I've proven in the research letters over the last year or so, I've proven that this is the largest bubble in history, and I've proven that it has been held, fueled, manipulated, however you want to describe it, by monetary policy. And I get that. I mean, they're trying to hold the thing together. So I understand. And when you put it under the microscope and look at it and look at the cause and effect of, like, reverse repos and the things they did to try to escalate rates, and you say, well, how's higher rates hold things up? Well, that's part of what I get into in the research letter, and you just have to understand that by reading it, this has all been a tool to hold this thing together, because I think they do know the dire consequences of when it goes. And if you or I or anybody else was in their shoes, you'd probably be doing the same thing, trying to hold it. But it's not sustainable. The question is, it's a juggling act. How long can they do this? I don't know. You don't know. They're doing their best to hold it together. But when it goes, we'll see it. We have to see. You know, there's certain a signature, if you will, DNA markers, or certain things that have to fall in place to mark this top. And you know, it's just like the 2020 top. You know, I saw that, called it perfectly. And I don't think this one will be any different. But until we get to that point where all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed, I think it's just a process. And I don't think they have the answer as far as how long it can hold it. Like I said, they're just trying to do the best they can, knowing the disaster that it's going to be when it goes. So that said, I think it's it is the biggest bubble in history. When it unravels, I think it's going to be devastating, absolutely devastating. I think it's going to be far worse than you know, everybody. We look back and nobody even thinks about it anymore, but they called the decline in 07, 08 into 09 the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. I think this eclipses that and probably even the Great Depression of the 20s. And I think that's why it's being fought so hard, and so that has made the process even lengthier, you know, but trying to fight and hold it so hard. But my long-term views have not changed in the least, but we have to get there.
Tim, how do you protect yourself from something like that?
You get out of the way. You get out of the way, because I think I don't think there's going to be a safe haven. I think the safe haven when it comes unraveled is just like if you look back at 2000, or you look at 07, 08, 09, or you look at 2020, it all went down together, everything, housing, you know, anything, everything, commodities, stocks, it all went down. And that's what I'm saying, and that's what I see here with this so-called checkmate chart that I in this sixth economic cycle that I've been talking about. But nobody's listening. Nobody cares. Everything's fine. Calm before the storm. You know, my house price is holding, and the 401k is good, and everything's fine, Jim. Everything's fine.
Tim, how can people sign up for your newsletter to maybe protect yourself from this bubble of everything blowing up?
Cyclesman.com. I do a monthly letter that, like I said, it's more of a research letter, hard data, and it's you know, I cover the things that we're talking about here and actually give evidence. It's not just opinion. It is hard evidence. So anyway, do with that information as someone wants, but it's available at cyclesman.com.
And I think somebody could call you Mr. Charts just as easily as Cycles Man.
That'll work.
My guest has been Tim Cyclesman Wood, editor of Cycles News and Views on cyclesman.com. He was speaking to us from Gulf Shores, Alabama. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Martin Strath, and Tim Cyclesman Wood. And we'd like to thank you for listening. If you have any questions for our guests or for the show, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.